I was the shy little boy at school who, when my parents went to parents' evening, the teacher couldn't remember me being there at all. The TfL job was without doubt the peak of my career, the thing I enjoyed most. Who wouldn't want to be working every day at the Olympic Park? I'm never retiring. That's for wimps, isn't it? You know, why would you retire? Why would I give this up?
Lunch with Leon.
Welcome to a very special Christmas edition of Lunch with Leon. My name is Simon Lederman. It's clear that I'm not Leon Daniels, but I have known Leon for some time. In fact, I think we met halfway between the railway station and here earlier today. Leon, welcome to your own podcast.
Well, thank you very much. This is a very odd experience because normally I'm the one fielding the questions and controlling how it all goes, and now it's you.
It is. And I am, I should say, Simon Lederman. I'm a broadcaster. Leon and I have worked together over several years. We've taken calls from fascinated and frustrated and adoring listeners to the BBC who've questioned Leon when he was at TfL, and we've done many other things in between, including almost taking over the controls of a helicopter at one stage. But we'll dig into that maybe a bit later. Can we start obviously talking about you and how on earth do you manage the demands that are placed on you, Leon?
Well, the front line of this is my wonderful executive assistant, Carly, who does a wonderful job in dealing with all of the people who are looking for slices of my time. She does an absolutely amazing job. She sorts out my diary. She makes sure I have all the papers that I need tonight for tomorrow. And also she looks after all my expenses and things. So the first line of attack, if you like, is Carly. In fact, you don't get anywhere without getting through to Carly, which is tremendous. But also, it is just about, you know, they do say, if you want something done, ask a busy person. I know lots of busy people, and they get loads of stuff done. And my good friend, Peter, Lord Hendy of Richmond Hill, he and I have known each other since we were teenagers. He's even busier than me, certainly now while he's the Minister for Rail in the current government. But in my case, never a house move or a childbirth where Peter's flowers and card weren't the first ones to arrive. So just goes to show people who are busy know how to get things done.
When I asked AI of the words that are associated with you having done a very deep search, I'm just going to very quickly go through the top 10. You'll understand where AI is coming. It's not particularly clever. Transport, London, bus, TfL, surface, managing, director, logistics, president, and CILT, which it said is a word, but obviously it isn't really. It's about five words. It's almost like all of your positions, but not necessarily in the right order. But there's something else that was missing from that list, which I you don't have to talk about. I don't think you should, because I don't think you'll want to. But philanthropy, because I know so many people who you have helped personally, professionally, when they're in times of either professional crisis or personal crisis. Those things are not known about, but I do know, and I'm saying it for the people that I know you've helped, that really should be on that list.
Well, that's, Simon, that's very kind of you, and you're right, we're not going to talk about it, as you might imagine. But what's the point of being on this planet and not doing positive things? And that applies, I think, all the time.
Right. I have to be very careful now because I'm going to move this microphone just a little bit.
All right.
And I'm going to give you the world's worst Christmas present. You have to open that and then you have to give it back to me.
Look at this. This is extraordinary. Look at that. Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Right.
It is the world's worst present because you must give it back to me once you've got the contents.
Okay. Okay. So this is...
Right. You can't open the envelope.
Oh, I have to give it back to you.
You do. Okay. You do.
There you go. Sorry.
Further, right. I've asked enough questions. We have questions from the audience, which I shall now, almost Academy Award style, open here. And
the winner is?
And the winner is always Leon Daniels, as we know. Right. So this is from Mark Griffin. The best bar you've ever been to.
Ah, right. In Barcelona, a beautiful James Bond-themed 007 bar. Absolutely extraordinary. No advertising. You have to know that it's there. It's on a particular street corner. The door is locked. You have to tap on the door and remind them that you're coming in. and the cocktails are extraordinary. So James Bond 007 theme bar, Barcelona.
Fantastic. I'm just going to write that down. Right. Belden Menkes says, Leon, what events or situations have you found most personally challenging over the time, and what lessons for others have you learned from them?
So the most challenging ever was the terrible Croydon tram crash in November 2016, with 7 dead and 50 injured. The worst accident during my time in TfL. The worst accident in terms of fatalities and so on for several, many years. Absolutely shocking, because we hadn't expected to have such a serious event on a tramway where, frankly, the trams are mixing with the ordinary traffic, as well as having some freehold sections of track. It's modern, it's run by a reputable operator, and there were many safeguards in place. And it was shocking to discover that it was possible to have this accident. It was shocking. And we wonder, of course, what happens many years later. We're now 9 years since the accident, and we wonder about all those people who were injured and who were traumatized by the event. It was appalling. We learned many lessons out of it. I often wonder, as we approach Christmas, what happened to the driver, because, of course, he left the organization, and I wonder how he celebrates his Christmas knowing that he was involved in such a terrible tragedy, because it's a long time ago, but the memories never go away.
This is from Harish Banrani, who says, Leon, how is AI helping in improving productivity by automating repetitive jobs?
Well, in the transport world, AI is marching on. And you've heard me say before that in some areas I would just settle for the I. But anyway, in the case of AI, it is starting to improve efficiency. For example, in operationalizing contracts, in making sure that components live longer and run for longer so that we don't get so many breakdowns, organizing the parking and the smart charging of our electric vehicles in the transport world. And it is taking away some of the more difficult jobs, the more routine jobs, and it's just making life more efficient and more productive. That in turn means that costs are being saved, and that, of course, ultimately in transport means it keeps the fares down.
Here is a voice you will recognise.
Merry Christmas, Leon. I hope you have a fabulous time and all the best for 2026. Now to my question. My day-to-day life right now centres around my 16-year-old son. He is passionate about physics, passionate about maths, a bright kid with an incredible work ethic. I take no responsibility for that, no idea where that came from. But with AI changing our world, and let's face it, a lot of uncertainty about how AI is going to affect work, affect jobs in the future. So my question is, finally I get to it, what advice would you give to a 16-year-old about how he approaches his future?
Well, thank you, Emma, very much. Your voice is familiar to many of us because it's your voice that we hear on the bus and indeed on the Elizabeth line every day, because you're announcing all of the stops and the stations.
Emma Hignett, we should give her full name check.
Bless her. Of course, the voice you hear on the bus and on the Elizabeth line is not her normal voice. She's a voiceover artist. She is, in fact, a Geordie. She comes from the north end of Durham. So, Emma, bless you. Been a guest on this podcast more than once. And I'm going to tell you an Emma story. So in 2014, Emma was on one of our buses in Regent Street as part of an event we were having. And Emma, for free, would put her bus voice and say anything you wanted her to say into your phone. She did 3 proposals of marriage, a couple of babies, lots of people's addresses. And she also managed to voice on 4 occasions into people's phones the following phrase: please move to your own side of the bed. Which I think isn't that just a brilliant announcement to have from Emma? Anyway, now she's asking the question, and she wants to know about her 16-year-old son, who, of course, is about to embark. Don't you just sometimes feel envious that these young people are about to start on their whole life?
I feel a mixture, but yes, you know, some of it is envy.
Yeah, some of it's envy. These people are just about, because you want to be you want to be 16, but with your everything you've learned over the last 50 years intact, don't you? I think what I'd say to Emma's son is that you have to find something you're passionate about and then try and see if you can earn your living at it. And who knows what it might be. It might be to do with technology or music, or it could be to do with the arts, it could be science, it could be anything. My recommendation is find something you're passionate about and see if you can't find a way of making it your livelihood. Because as we said earlier, if you're doing something you really enjoy and find satisfying, then you really are going to get a lot out of life. It's a tragedy, isn't it, to spend 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week doing something you hate in order to earn enough money to eat and live. So my recommendation, go find something you're really passionate about and really see what you can do with it. Especially since, unlike Simon, when you and I were 16, we didn't have the internet to do some of the heavy lifting for us. And frankly, everything that's available through online research, there's just somebody somewhere doing something about everything. And let's just see, Emma, your son, go do some serious research and see what you can do. I would also just say that, especially if you're 16, one of the things that hampered me in my career was I never really studied modern languages well enough. And what a huge disadvantage that has been for the whole of my life. And I know we have Google Translate, and I know all sorts of things are now possible. But the lack of ability to talk colloquially with some of our nearest neighbors in Europe has been such a huge disadvantage. And, you know, I'm on the senior international leadership team at RATP Dev, and they have to switch into English for my benefit. So I'm going to say to all those other people out there at 16 who are thinking about what to do, do just do what you can with the modern languages, because I promise you, as we become more global, the fact you have Google Translate is only half a help if you're actually stood in a bar trying to talk to somebody in their language.
And we wish you bon chance. many thanks for that. More questions to come. I mean, just very briefly, the other issue with beginning a career now is when we were beginning careers, it looked like we would be in the same career with roughly the same architecture around us forever. This could be 16 careers.
It could indeed. The days of people working for 40 odd years, as my father did, 40 odd years for one employer doing one career is gone, I think, for a long time. There's almost no benefit now. In fact, it works against you if you appear to have a long career. So we are looking, I think, for people who will change their jobs and possibly their whole area of activity more than several times during the course of their lifetime. Because, of course, the science and technology is making the change happen more often. So therefore, bound to be, you have to adapt. And, you know, I have a friend who started out life as a graphic designer, and a very good one he is too. But sadly, it's of no benefit now, because the moment desktop publishing arrived in Microsoft Word and Word Perfect and so on, he was half out of a job. And then later, now that the computer can do it all for you, there's no business left. So you have to evolve and have to change.
That question is a good push for us to talk about early stages of your career. What was your first job in transport?
Oh, well, depends where you want to start, but let's start in the first place where I earned any money. So I was in what is now the Department for Transport. It was then the Department of Environment. The transport bit was underneath it. And I, amongst the things I did there, I was the first member of the Bill team that delivered what's now the Highways Act 1980. But we did all that work in the 1970s. It was an extraordinary piece of legislation. Of course, I can remember it all like it was yesterday. That's, you know, it's an amalgamation of the 1959, 1961 Highways Acts. And it was a consolidation, which meant that there was no new legislation. We just had to make sure we enacted all the bits of the legislation that was there. And we couldn't change anything. And we found some mistakes in it. And I remember having these long conversations with the parliamentary draftsmen and ministers and so on about what we could do. Believe it or not, the Secretary of State had powers to lop down trees in the West Country, which was there because in the days before roads were made of tarmac, they were simply mud. And if you didn't cut down the trees, the sun didn't dry the mud, and therefore they were not navigable. Not really necessary in 1980. not helped by the fact that it was missed out of the Local Government Act 1972, which means it referred to the old counties in the West Country. So as you drove across Avon, which is a modern county, as you crossed the old Somerset boundary, which no longer had any effect, the Secretary of State now had powers to lop down trees he didn't want. Bizarrely, this had to be reenacted in the 1980 bill, although it's been taken out subsequently. What great fun for a young person to be...
Was it great? Can I say something? Don't take this the wrong way. It does not sound great fun.
It was.
Was it great fun?
It was great fun.
Why was it great fun?
Listen, there are very few of us left in the world, but I am one of the few people ever in the civil service to have to get the government whips to get the government to vote out its own amendment because my minister was speaking on the wrong side.
Okay.
You know.
There's a bit of fun there.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Isn't that just
great? I'll take it. When was the first time that you walked through the doors of London Transport? Because that's been, am I wrong to kind of almost define your career by the years at LT or not?
Okay, well, really the first time that I walked through the door of 55 Broadway in a professional way, as opposed to being some young person trying to get some maps and timetables, when the advent of franchising in London was first put forward, which is in the mid-1980s, the leading people in the private bus and coach sector were invited to a session at 55 Broadway. And I was in a lift with many other people who became luminaries like Len Wright and Simon Newman and so on. And we were all in the lift in 55 Broadway. And the only way I can describe it is we were all like, do you remember when you were at school and you were allowed into the staff room and you were sort of looking around like this all the time, thinking, wow, this is amazing. That was all of us in 55 Broadway. So to answer your question, that must have been 1984 when we were first there. And we first started to interact with these faceless people in London Transport who we'd only ever heard about and who were often only referred to by their surnames.
Legendary.
Absolutely legendary. And there we were, after all these years, we'd been let into the staff room.
What was your role? What was your first position in?
Oh, so that was us at Ensign Bus when we were looking to see if we were going to bid for bus route contracts, as we did, and we succeeded in the second phase with Route 145.
So you were, I didn't realise, so you were doing that before you'd ever had a staff job with London Transport?
Oh, yes, indeed.
I was
only in the public sector at the beginning and end of my career.
Right.
In the Department of Environment when I first started, bookended by TfL at the end.
I didn't realise.
And I was in the private sector the whole of the rest of the time.
Did the 145 run on time?
It ran beautifully. It also ran beautifully because it didn't run in the evening or on Sundays, which made it really easy to recruit for. Those were the days between Redbridge and Dagenham. It still runs. And it now runs to Leytonstone. But
if you had a preference, you could have only had one part of your career inside the private sector or inside the public sector. Which is your most passionate years that you remember?
I'm going to dodge the question, as you might imagine. I couldn't have done the TfL job.
Do you think, just in principle, do you think you need to be that diplomatic? Serious question, because this is you. It's a preference. It's not whether one is right or wrong.
No, but it's a bit binary. I couldn't have done the TfL job if I hadn't done all that in the private sector in my time. So the TfL job was without doubt the peak of my career, the thing I enjoyed most. Who wouldn't want to be working every day at the Olympic Park? So the TfL and the Olympic Games was the peak of my career. But I couldn't have done it without the decades of private sector experience that got me there. So if you ask me which was the best bit, well, the public sector was the best bit, but only because of the private sector work that had come before it.
How many types of vehicle can you drive?
I don't know.
Can you operate?
That's impossible to work out.
But for most people, it isn't, which I think is why it's interesting to ask. So for me, in terms of what I know about you, I'd say 7 types of tube train. I'd say probably at least 20 types of buses.
You never quite recovered from when I got you a cab ride on the district line. But
no, because you were driving.
Yes,
I didn't realise you would be driving.
You weren't expecting that. Under the watchful guidance of Trevor Wright, of course.
Indeed.
Who's a listener of this programme. Yes, because we were just trying to get a ride on the last D78 stock before they went out of service. Sure.
In a serious question, because presumably there are not many, I don't think there are many people who could take their success at one mode of transport that, yeah, I can, like, you are somebody who I think has the confidence to say, yeah, I can do that. I can do that, even though I don't do it all the time.
Yeah. So I'll give a bit of personal thing away now. I was the shy little boy at school who, when my parents went to parents' evening, the teacher couldn't remember me being there at all. I was the shy little boy at the back who didn't say anything. And which was a great disappointment to my father in particular, who was a very jolly, rotund Yorkshireman who saw fun in everything and, you know, thought it would be normal to try and put a ice cream cone in the open mouth of somebody sleeping on the beach. You know, he just naturally thought those things.
Do you think
were
funny. You were quiet because you were in his shadow?
It could have been so, but of course he died when I was 16.
Right.
And then my personality changed. So he never saw me being the sort of person that you've described. He only ever knew me as a shy little boy, so...
But you always had, presumably, you had that confidence within. It just hadn't had a chance to...
Yeah, well, as I say, either because I didn't get any chance because he was being the person that he was, or it hadn't developed at that time. I don't know. But then you say confidence, and this is a message to everybody, especially the young people, you can do anything you want if you put your mind to it. You can do absolutely anything, mm-hmm. and... People sometimes are negative, if you like, about ambition. But ambition sounds like you're going to push other people out of the way so you can succeed. That's not what I consider to be ambition. Ambition is about you yourself having the confidence and gaining the ability to do things that you might want to do. And so here I am at my age, absolutely fascinated to learn that I can, on my own computer at home, now start to get something that looks like me talking about something that I haven't said in front of a scene that I haven't been in. I think that's pretty clever. And who wouldn't want to learn how to do that?
Are you really here?
I'm definitely really here, yeah.
One thing that really requires confidence, I think for many people, is going it alone. So you spent years in the private sector, you spent time in the public sector, you obviously have been in both, and the private sector can still be scary, even if there's people around you. Now, 2025 and in the past, you are now going it alone. Did that take a big decision?
Oh, no. When I retired from TFL, I simply decided that I was going to do all sorts of different things. So there was no choice about it. It wasn't a big jump at all. It was just effectively just carrying on what I was doing before, but only doing the good bits. The great thing about working on your own, you only have to work for the people you want to work for, and you only have to do the things you want to do, and you can turn all the rest of it down. So that was relatively easy. And of course I miss the TFL time, and I definitely miss the people. But actually, of course, my memory of it is the good bits. I actually don't much miss the bad bits, of which there were some, as there are in every job. So, this is living a dream. I get to go to all sorts of places, do all sorts of things, meet all sorts of clever people doing all sorts of clever tech. I mean, what's not to like about that? In fact, I listened to an interview the other day, Simon, Jonathan Frakes, Riker in Star Trek, who is a producer, director, writer, and actor. He's older than me. And the interviewer said, "When are you going to give up?" He said, "Why would I give up? Why would I stop making movies? Why would I stop writing? Why would I stop performing? Why would I give it up?" Good answer.
I'm going to go back to some audience listener response questions. This is from Simon Cussio, who says, "Leon, everyone knows your great achievements in our wonderful industry, which obviously we've talked a lot about. But family aside, what do you consider is your greatest or favourite non-industry moment?"
Wow. That's a typically intelligent, deep question.
I told
from
you
Simon.
They were profound.
They were very good. I am doing all sorts of other things on the edges. As you know, I've been the chairman at Thames Clippers, which is public transport, of course, and I'm now still a director at Clippers. And
but so public transport where you can get a G&T on board.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that wonderful?
That's my kind of public transport.
It is. That's how it should. That's how it should be for everybody. But in terms of greatest, other greatest achievements, I mean, there's just been loads of things I've really enjoyed doing. That creative stuff, including this podcast, of course, is a great joy for me to do and to interview some amazing people. I mean, the guest list on this podcast, it's worth going back and listening to some of the older ones, and Will Whitehorn, who is Richard Branson's right-hand man, was there. We're doing an amazing episode about space travel and everything we can learn now from satellites and how there's less food going rotten in the docks as a result of space technology, all sorts of wonderful things. So, you know, that's not transport at all.
Songfest.
Ah, I wonder why you would choose that. So how do we get into Songfest? So a very old friend of mine is a pop star from the 1970s. His name is Dean Friedman. And many listeners will have heard Dean Friedman's famous song, which made it to the top of our charts, Lucky Star, which he sang in a duet with a wonderful American lady called Denise Marser. So I've known Dean a very long time. He and I are about the same age, and he still gets great enjoyment for doing the things that he likes doing, which is mostly to do with music and singing and putting on concerts and so on. Songfest is a particular event that we do together, and we do this because it's a way of combining some older, aging pop stars and some
who've still got it, by the way.
Who've absolutely still got it. And we pair them up together at this event with some young and upcoming musicians. So young and upcoming musicians get the chance to play with Mike Batt, for goodness sake, with Graham Gouldman, for goodness sake.
With Tom Robinson.
And this year with Tom Robinson. Who wouldn't want to sing 2468 Motorway with Tom Robinson if you're a 20-year-old budding young musician? So Dean headlines this, coming back again, August Bank Holiday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday in 2026 at a hotel in Rugby, the Draycote Hotel. Again, go to the website for Songfest and you will see Dean. You'll see Richard Digents. You'll see a whole heap of stars and some new people. And from Ed Adu and your good self, we'll be in good company.
Did you ever imagine you'd get up to, we're into the hundred and teens now with your Lunch with Leon podcast, of which you are an esteemed guest this week. Did you ever imagine it was going to get into triple digits?
No, never, never. In fact, the lifetime of podcasts is very short. I never imagined it would, but it's great fun. And it's non-transport related. I promise you, I'm spending my evening editing the audio of some of these podcasts, and it's great creative fun. In fact, I often think that my favourite part of it is mixing all the tracks together at the end, which is not my skill at all. That's your skill.
we'll find out at the end of this. This is Nigel Wood, who asks you, what has been the most significant change you've witnessed in the transport industry over the past 45 years?
So, the biggest thing, I guess, over the last 45 years has to be the move away to net zero. That has to be the biggest move. We've been refining and refining the diesel engine now ever since. Well, as you know, one of the reasons why the firm Ricardo exists is that Sir Harry Ricardo was commissioned by the UK government because during World War One, the black smoke coming out of the diesel engines told the Germans where our tanks were. So Sir Harry Ricardo refined the diesel engines sufficiently well that diesel replaced petrol as the energy source for buses, coaches, and trucks. Fast forward, we've been refining the diesel engine decade after decade. This move to zero emission, net zero energy is extraordinary. The science for hydrogen, the science for battery electric is extraordinary. And everything about it is different. We've been running our transport business on the basis that our buses and trucks and coaches leave the depot every morning full of fuel. Now this is a whole different ball game. So I think, Nigel, that this whole move to zero emission is one of the biggest steps that we've had to take. And it's not, we tried in the early 1970s, but we didn't have the battery technology or the software, and now we do.
Here's another voice you might recognise.
Hi, Leon. It's Peter here. On a Sunday afternoon, having done my paperwork, done all the odd jobs, not going anywhere smart, so I don't need to shave or put on a tie. What I'd like to know is, what lessons for the future can we derive from our past? That's a good question for people as old as you and me. Cheers. Bye.
Well, Peter, of course, remembers that when, for a period of time, my bus company in London was owned by the Hong Kong Chinese, our wonderful chairman, T.T. Choi, dead now, I'm afraid, he brought a delegation of people from Hong Kong. And during his time in London, we took a trip to the London Transport Museum because we were hoping that he would agree for us to be corporate sponsors. And before the last of the 50 Chinese delegation went in through the front door, TT was coming out. And I thought, this has gone terribly badly. This is really bad. And I said, oh, TT, what's the... You didn't like it? He said, no, it's fine. Yeah, we become sponsors. And I said, well, you've only been in like 5 minutes. He said, it's very simple. Answers to all the troubles of today contained in our history. And I, that's really useful. And Peter's question is on point with that. Because all the things that some of the younger people think they invented, like customer service and good information and cleanliness and so on, we had and we threw it away. So I think history reminds us that that we should always make sure we're delivering the highest quality information, we're doing that the staff are well-dressed and presented, that we're giving good customer service. All of those things are the typical things that we forget about if we're not careful. And we always forget about them if the accountants are in charge because they represent a cost. And so therefore, out of our history, let's never forget that we've been round the loop a couple of times now in some of those softer subjective areas, and we mustn't lose it now.
This, I think, is a really tough question, and I'm going to stare at you while you answer and watch the brain, the Leon Daniels brain whirring. This is from Simon Posner, who says, you are Secretary of State for Transport. What is the first thing you would do? And not resign, right?
Well, I must be very careful not to upset my good friend Heidi Alexander, who is the Secretary of State for Transport, and we really don't want to. We don't want to spoil that relationship.
But you'd get on with the minister, wouldn't you?
Well, firstly, I get on with the minister because it's Peter. But don't worry. Although Peter and I have worked together on several occasions, I have no intention of becoming the Secretary of State. So we can have.
That's
fun
what they
this.
All say. Well, what is the first thing you would do?
Well, It's a tough one because really when you take on a job like that, the first thing you should do is listen and learn. It's quite easy to turn up and start firing off shots, but actually listening and learning is such an underrated business attribute. It is just amazing if you listen and discover things. So before you do something, you have to absorb what it is that's going on and understand. So listening and learning. Sounds like a cop-out, but that is the first thing that you should do. But very early on my list, so possibly first, would be to recognize that in the Department for Transport, for which you would be the Secretary of State, that there is very little work on integration on the passenger side between bus, coach and rail. And there's even less integration between freight logistics and passenger. Despite the fact that it's the same manufacturers make the same vehicles, it's the same driver and vehicle standards agency that tests the drivers and tests the vehicles and pronounce them to be safe, it's the same annual testing regime. We're running on the same streets using the same tarmac. We're blocking up the same bits of curbside space for bus stops, but for loading and delivering and coaches and so on. So the thing I would do, Simon, is I would knock down the wall that separates rail from everybody else in passenger transport, and then the floor between the passenger side and the freight logistics side.
I think this may have to be the last question, but I'm going to, if we have time before we finish, I will try and find some more. But the questions have been fantastic, so thank you to all of those.
Sadly, the answers haven't quite matched the quality, but there we are.
Well, actually, funny enough, I was thinking if this were a job interview, you would be one of those candidates who would be sitting there, I'd be thinking, he's gotten a job. I have to feel he's gotten a job. Caroline Wilson says, Leon, do you think the industry will ever reach 50-50 gender balance? If not, what do you think the main blocker to that is?
Firstly, I'm sure it will. But although I take issue with 50-50, I have a different view about the gender balance. The balance of the staff should reflect the gender balance of the users. And if, as it may appear to be the case, there are more female than male passengers, then there should be more female than male staff. And that's everywhere from operating through to management and so on. So 50-50 isn't the aim for me. What we should do is we should reflect the gender balance of the users.
Some quick fire from me, which hopefully will either get you in trouble because you have to think very quickly or just make us learn a little bit.
And the reason I'm smiling is I did this to you, didn't I?
You did. Your immediate reaction to the following, almost like you're on the psychiatrist's couch.
Yeah, I'm feeling it.
Renationalisation of GB Rail.
The quick answer is simple. The public is demanding something different. The public isn't necessarily very clear what it would like, but it wants something different. And if it's currently in private sector hands, then it needs to be in public sector hands. I think it's fair that given the huge amount of money that's going into rail, which, as you know, is 3%, I think, of the whole government spend. If public money is going into it, the public has to have a say in it. So since the public is demanding a change and since it is putting so much money in, it's got to be the right thing.
Apologies for this London-centric pedestrianisation of Oxford Street.
I'm against it, and I told the mayor I was against it in our time. It was, of course, I think, an election pledge, which is the reason why he's brought it forward. The reason I'm against the pedestrianisation of Oxford Street is there is almost no nightlife in Oxford Street. No restaurants, no pubs, bars and so on. And therefore, when retail shuts down and goes home, at the moment, it's the traffic that keeps it clean. If there's no traffic and no nightlife, it could easily become quite unsavoury at night and overnight. So for the moment, at night, the traffic keeps it clean. Of secondary issues, there are tens of thousands of people that board and alight from buses in Oxford Street every day. And a lot of those people are actually staff. And these are lower paid retail staff for whom the underground is a much more expensive option. So for that reason, I would leave the buses in Oxford Street as well. And then there are these fanciful notions, which I love, including we should replace the buses in Oxford Street with a tram, to which I always say, where are you going to park them at night? Are you going to put them in Hyde Park? Or where are you going to put them? The nearest depot would be Old Oak Common, so you'd have to build a tram all the way from Marble Arch to the other side of Paddington. So we're not going to have a tram in Oxford Street. We appear to be going to have pedestrianised Oxford Street, and I'm worried that it won't be such a nice place at night.
HS2.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we've probably started from the wrong end, didn't we? We should have started in the north and gone south. So HS2 is now such a terrible problem. You wouldn't start from here if you wanted to. Just about everything about HS2 is wrong one way or another. Mark Wilde is doing a fabulous job trying to get it under control. Mark and I work together in TfL. But, of course, the desire for such amazing line speeds means the technical sophistication is very complicated. The line has to be very straight. Because the line is straight, it has to go through people's land. They don't want it going through their land, so it's in cuttings or tunnels. You're only going to be in daylight for a short period on the journey. It's costing a phenomenal amount of money, driven especially by the line speeds, and not helped at all by the fact that the whole civil engineering work on HS2 is a cost-plus contract, which is a consequence of the failure of Carillion many years ago. So huge amounts of money, huge technical sophistication. Sadly, paraphrasing Macbeth, going back would be more difficult than to go forwards.
Very briefly, last one, Waymo yes. coming to London. Now, I know you've had experience of Waymo. This is autonomous cars. Mm. Waymo coming to London.
Well, standing by for the huge abuse from the taxi trade that will follow as a result of this broadcast.
Something new to you.
Something I thought I'd finished with. So I was in a Waymo in San Francisco in September, people said to me, did you feel unsafe? And I said, no, I felt unsafe by the crazy guy that drove me from the airport who was hooting and shouting and veering all over the carriageway and shouting abuse out of the window. That was unsafe. The Waymo I rode in San Francisco was very calm, very quiet, driven beautifully, and just amazing. Little things like when it pulls up to drop you off, it's not aware of its surroundings, and it might be dropping you off in the middle of a football fight. So it just says, Do you feel safe to leave the vehicle here? If so, say yes, and I'll unlock the doors. Isn't that lovely? That's really very good. So, look, it's coming. It is very exciting. My colleague Christian Woolmar, another guest on this podcast, of course, doesn't believe it will ever happen. I think it will. But my prediction is the earliest autonomous vehicles won't be in the West End of London, really. The earliest ones will be more like 8-10-seater super taxis that will emerge in some of our quieter suburban rail stations where there isn't the demand for ordinary public transport and where the equation of a vehicle and a driver makes it uneconomic. But actually, take the driver out of the equation, and a little 8, 9, 10-seater that takes you and several others from the railway station to 3 or 4 destinations in the vicinity. Technically easier, doesn't need to know everywhere to everywhere, just needs to know in the vicinity. And that's where we'll get all our experience on autonomous vehicles. But as I say, my absolute experience with Waymo has been absolutely brilliant. One last thing on autonomous vehicles, if I may. They will not be perfect, and there will be injuries and even fatalities. But on the roads of Great Britain at the moment, there are 4 or 5 fatalities a day caused by humans driving vehicles. So I simply leave that hanging. Autonomous vehicles will be safer, but not perfect. Will society accept a smaller number of deaths and injuries from autonomous vehicles in the way they tolerate 4 or 5 a day by humans?
Really briefly, because we are now up to time, what is next for Leon Daniels? For those people who've just tuned in, have you retired?
I'm never retiring. That's for wimps, isn't it? You know, why would you retire? To quote what I said earlier with Jonathan Frakes, why would I give this up? I've got taught, as you know, to create, perform, and put together music by an 18-year-old student in the Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane when I was there doing a speech. So I went and did my speech, and then this young student taught me how to do AI music. I mean, why would you give up? Why would you retire from that? So no, I'm afraid to say I'm here plaguing all of you, lobbying, representing, speaking my mind, and travelling until the doctor tells me I can't.
And this is our Christmas edition, a special Christmas edition of Lunch with Leon. Tell us very briefly about Christmas in the Leon Daniels house.
Oh, that's very simple. My wife's birthday is December the 30th, which is a terrible day for a birthday because you've just had Christmas and tomorrow is New Year's Eve. So I've learnt now for some years that I can deal with Christmas, birthday and New Year in one single air ticket. So we will be in Cape Town.
Fantastic. See, this is why you're so good at your job. Thank you to all of those who sent questions through. Thank you to you, Leon Daniels, for your honesty, your absolute openness to talk about your time. And it's been an honour, albeit one-off, to host your own podcast with you. You'll be back next time. Happy Christmas to you watching and to you, Leon.
And happy Christmas to you, Simon, and to all the people who are subscribing to Lunch with Leon.